Welcome to the latest episode of On the Case from EG. The Supreme Court has given judgment in Alexander Devine Children's Cancer Trust v. Housing Solutions Limited, a case involving a restrictive covenant and competing public interests between, on the one hand, a development of much needed social housing, and on the other, a neighbouring charity seeking to preserve the privacy of a hospice for terminally ill children. Joining me to discuss the case today are Chris Stoner QC and Andrew Francis from Searle Court Chambers. Great to speak to you both.
And you, Jess.
Now, I've outlined the very core nature of the dispute, but can you go into a bit more detail on the restrictive covenant involved here and the parties and what led to this litigation?
Yeah, if I take that one, Andrew, I suppose the tale starts as far back as 1972 when a farmer sold part of his land, which was referred to in the Supreme Court as the application land, to a company that already owned some land next door on which it had some industrial buildings. And the application land and its previously owned land together formed a nice rectangular site for it. The company purchaser entered into what were some very straightforward and simple covenants, which were firstly not to build, there should be no building structure or other erection of whatsoever nature shall be built, erected, or placed on the application land. And secondly, the application land shall not be used for any purpose whatsoever other than as an open space for the parking of motor vehicles. So very, very straightforward, thou shalt not build and thou shalt use as a parking area. Moving forward, that was in 1972. We then move into 2011, 2012. And in 2012, the farmer's son had inherited his late father's land, the retained land, and he'd agreed to, and he did gift part of the land next to the rectangular site to the trust, the Alexander Devine Children's Cancer Trust, for the worthy cause of a children's hospice. Now, Millgate, the developer, came onto the scene in 2013, and the judgments record that they had knowledge of the covenants. They obtained planning permission to build 23 affordable homes on the rectangular site, 13 of which were going to be on the application land, namely the land burdened by the covenant. And some of those 13 homes would overlook the hospice grounds, where there was evidence that the children would be enjoying those grounds, given their difficulties. The reason that Millgate were building the 23 affordable homes was that that was part of a Section 106 agreement to facilitate it building 75 homes elsewhere. So the council required it to build those affordable homes. Millgate started the building in 2014, and that was when Barty Smith became aware of what was happening, and he objected. And there was then an exchange of correspondence, but the building continued. And indeed, Millgate completed the 23 affordable homes, including the 13 homes on the burdened land, before it made an application under Section 84 to the Upper Tribunal for modification of the covenants. I suppose I should also add, by way of relevant background, I think that Millgate also sold, prior to its application, but Millgate had sold conditionally the 23 affordable homes and all the associated land to Housing Solutions. And the condition was that there was no reasonable risk of any court application being successful effectively to enforce the covenants by an injunction or stopping or restricting the development. And Millgate also provided some insurance policies and an indemnity. So it's also relevant, by way of background, I think, to note that before the tribunal hearing, the Section 106 agreement was varied. There was obviously concerns as to what would happen at that hearing. And the 106 agreement was varied to permit Millgate to pay £1.6 million to the council if the application was not successful. And as a result, the property could not be transferred to Housing Solutions. In fact, the developer Millgate was successful in the upper tribunal. They concluded that the covenant should be modified upon the payment of £150,000 compensation. We now know, of course, that the matter went to the Court of Appeal. But before it went to the Court of Appeal, the transfer to Housing Solutions went ahead. In fact, it went ahead on the day before the time limit for appealing expired. But the consequence of that is that Millgate did not have to pay the £1.6 million. The transfer went straight ahead to Housing Solutions, who became the owners. What we also know is that the Court of Appeal overturned the Upper Tribunal decision. They found that the Upper Tribunal had erred on four grounds, and they therefore found in favour of the trust the covenant was to be enforced. And so Housing Solutions then appealed to the Supreme Court, effectively on the same four grounds. And hence that led to the decision that we had last week.
Yeah, and it's perhaps surprisingly, it's the first time the Supreme Court has had to consider Section 84 of the Law of Property Act 1925, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah.
So Lord Burrows gave the court's decision. What was his analysis of the position?
Well, if I start off before passing on to Andrew, one important point, because he classified Millgate's approach as being a cynical breach. Mm. He said that they deliberately committed a breach of the restrictive covenant with a view to making profit from doing so. And the two grounds of appeal that he concentrated on had at their core that cynical breach, and they were the jurisdiction or the gateway provision within Section 84 and also the discretionary element. And on the jurisdiction and how they determine that, over to Andrew.
Yes, thank you very much, Christopher. Yes, the real two questions that came up before the Supreme Court, and it's interesting to note as regards Jess's comments just made, which is that as this is the first time that this jurisdiction's come before the Supreme Court in just shy of 100 years since its creation in 1926, the test for going to the Supreme Court is a pretty high threshold one, namely that you've got to show a point of law of general public importance in broad terms, at least applicable to this type of case. And therefore, the Supreme Court was charged with looking at some core points that arise fairly frequently in these types of application. And the two core points are what we might call the gateway or jurisdiction question, which arises under the various grounds that people can apply under or use. The second is the underlying discretion question, which is that effectively, even if you win and can successfully go through one of your gateways, if there are things which are against you as the applicant relevant to discretion, you may still have come away with nothing. So the two questions that the Supreme Court was faced with was the Court of Appeal right to allow the trust's appeal from the tribunal? And secondly, if it was right, what should the Supreme Court do? So that anybody who's not yet looked at the judgments are not kept in suspense, I can say that the spoiler alert is this, that the Supreme Court dismissed the appeal from the Court of Appeal, and rather than remit the case back to the tribunal, dismissed the application itself. So in outline, Millgate came away with absolutely nothing, and effectively an order for costs, which I gather is now being the subject of a dispute. So one probably then moves to the question, why did the Supreme Court make the decision it did? It did so for a number of reasons, and I should also add at this stage that this is quite a complicated judgment, and the reasoning is actually quite difficult at some stage, without any hint of criticism, difficult to follow because this is a complex area of law. But the Supreme Court made the decision it did on the following basis. On the jurisdiction point, the gateway point, it held that the ground that is sometimes relied on, albeit rarely, which is that it would be contrary to the public interest for the covenant to impede the proposed user. This is in section 84(1), capital A, little b. It's a slightly more tricky ground on which to apply, and which most people would fail. On that ground, the Supreme Court said it meant what it said. In other words, there's no gloss that should be applied to the question whether in impeding the proposed user, that is, as a result of the covenant, that is contrary to the public interest. So it's a narrow inquiry. And the cynical breach described by Lord Burroughs and referred to just now by Chris was not relevant to the question of whether the gateway, the public interest gateway, could be satisfied. So the manner of breach, all the other things, was not relevant to that. They also held that the what I often call the omnium gatherum provision, which is section 84(1), capital B, which is the material things which the tribunal must take into account, including all the planning policies and any other material facts, that was where the Court of Appeal had actually gone wrong on that. And what I might refer to with great respect as Lord Justice Sales, as he then was, now Lord Sales, conduct lecture at paragraph 64 of the Court of Appeal's judgment, where Lord Sales gives a pretty strict lecture about what developers must or must not do, was wrong in terms of its engagement at the jurisdiction stage. We'll come back to that point in due course when we look at a point that arose later in the judgments on remedies. So that's the first point. In other words, the jurisdiction stage upholds the principle that the gateway provisions are to be strictly construed. I don't know if Chris has got anything to add to that before I bring in the question of what it found on discretion.
No, I haven't, Andrew. It was a commendably short point that has effectively restored the notion that it is purely a gateway.
Yeah. So then on discretion, this is where the trust won, in a sense, in the dismissal of the appeal from the Court of Appeal. The first thing was that the Supreme Court did not agree with the way in which the tribunal had assessed the effect of the cynical conduct of what was then Millgate. The Supreme Court found that there was, and agreed with the Court of Appeal, that there had been an error of law committed by the tribunal. But the Supreme Court did not agree with the way in which the Court of Appeal explained that error. Now, one doesn't want to get too much into detail here because there is quite a lot of law on what amounts to an error of law in appeals when you're trying to persuade the appellate court that something's gone wrong, error of law, and where discretions have to be exercised. There's a lot of law on that. I don't think it would be right to go into that today. But the real question was, well, did the tribunal fail to take into account anything beyond the cynical conduct of Millgate? And it considered whether there should be some principle, a broad principle, that an applicant who commits a cynical breach should have his application refused, and almost an automatic traffic barrier to entering it into the gateway. As a matter of principle, if you do this and if you do that, you are going to be stopped at the border. In other words, that discretion should trump jurisdiction. The Supreme Court didn't really like that very much and thought that was a bad idea, partly because you're going to have to provide exceptions to that general rule. So it then had a look what could be done effectively to dismiss the appeal. It seems, if I may respectfully say so, reading between the lines, that the Supreme Court was keen, if that's the right word, or was prepared to find that Millgate should not succeed in its appeal, and it clearly needed some form of peg on which to hang the hat of dismissing the appeal. Now, that's not meant to sound, and it's not intended to sound in any sense cynical, because this was obviously a very careful examination at the highest court level of what had happened before. And what the Supreme Court found was that two errors of law had been committed by the tribunal. And these were described by Lord Burrows as the two omitted factors. The first factor was that Millgate could have developed on the unencumbered land. A plan of the site shows that the rectangle was in the northwestern part, about a third of the land, unencumbered, and it was the southern and southeastern part, taking a diagonal line, almost a bar sinister across the site, it was the southeastern and southern part that was encumbered. So about two-thirds of the land was encumbered, and the top part was not bound by any covenants. Now, in the evidence, it was clear that Millgate could have built on that land, and the local planning authority, Maidenhead Borough Council, would have been in favour of such an application, but it chose not to do so. So that first factor was where Millgate had put paid to a satisfactory outcome for it if it had chosen to go down that route. The second, and this is the crucial one, was that Millgate had failed to apply to the tribunal before starting to build on the whole site, including, of course, the encumbered land. Now, curiously enough, and for reasons that Chris has just described and outlined by way of background, there were some exchanges of correspondence between Barty Smith and solicitors acting for Millgate in the early days, but the solicitors acting for Millgate had more or less brushed off any allegations that Barty Smith made himself, that stage he didn't have solicitors, that there was a covenant that bound and could be enforced against Millgate, and it was that brushing off which I shall come to in due course. Now, as the effect of the cynical breach was so extreme, in other words, they carried on building and finished until they went to the tribunal, the Supreme Court said, well, Millgate could hardly rely on the public interest ground as a matter of jurisdiction when its own breach had to be used to support that ground, the often referred to, and indeed referred to in the judgment of Lord Burrows, as the fait accompli point. So the tribunal, as I say, having rejected any arguments on the jurisdiction point, also was wrong at its discretion stage as well. So that's where the Supreme Court emphasizes, and we'll come to this in due course when we look at the lessons to be learned, where the Supreme Court dealt quite heavily with Millgate on its conduct. Chris, I don't know if there's anything you want to add to that before we come to the other issues that were necessary for the decision.
No, I think it's tempting to say that as soon as the Supreme Court had found that Millgate were in cynical breach, they were never going to succeed on the appeal without being cynical about the cynical breach. I think that is, yes, that is realistic. And it is a powerful point that Lord Burrows refers to, that that was expressed by Stephen Jordan in the case, where he said it's not in the public interest that a person who deliberately breaches a restrictive covenant should be able to secure the modification of the covenant in reliance, yes, on the state of affairs created. Yes. And that is a powerful point. And one can see, therefore, that in many instances, in other factual scenarios, one could work back from that and say, well, you're not going to get a modification in those circumstances. But ultimately, of course, yes, the case was decided on the narrow omissions, yes, from the upper tribunal.
Yes, that's the narrow ground. But I think the wider ground is what you've just said, Chris, and it really goes back to the days of the Courts of Equity at one end of Westminster Hall, where if you came to equity, you had to have clean hands. And it was quite clear, yeah, that Millgate didn't have clean hands. So there we are. So may I then turn, I hope reasonably briefly, to the other issues. They weren't necessary for the main decision. And 2 points, really. One is quite a complicated point, but in relative terms, it's quite simple. There was a discussion, both in submissions and also reference to it made by Lord Burrows, about the application of the decision of the Supreme Court in Lawrence and Fentigers back in February 2014, which is the famous case on injunctions and remedies. There was a discussion about the application of that by analogy to the facts of this case. Now, this is not the time or the occasion one has to dive back into the judgments of the Supreme Court given then, where we have the main judgment of Lord Neuberger and then the other subsidiary judgments of Lord Mansfield, Carnwath and Lord Sumption. And there are nuances between them where one can take certain things out of the respective judgments and say, ah, well, for example, and this was the point here, if you've got planning consent, you shouldn't be subject to an injunction. The Supreme Court said, apropos this point, and this is all using the latter obiter dicta, in other words, it's not necessary for the decision, it said that the tribunal had failed to consider the wider comments of Lord Sumption on the principle of remedies or of injunctions or damages. And really, one can simply say and dispel this particular point by saying, well, it's all very interesting. It wasn't necessary for the decision of the Supreme Court in this particular case. But what it does do, and this is a point we'll come on to in due course when we look at lessons, what it does do is reaffirms the primacy of Fentigers. And the other point, which is a very small point, really, in relative terms, was the point that arose out of the revised Section 106 agreement that Chris referred to in his outline, his opening. This was where Millgate could avoid the liability to provide the 13 affordable home units by the payment of the 1.6 million to Maidenhead Borough Council. The Supreme Court considered that the tribunal had taken this point into account, but that the tribunal had treated the point as outweighed by the need to preserve the affordable housing units. In other words, the tribunal had gone slightly wrong in what might call the emphasis. And the tribunal had actually correctly referred to this point at the discretion stage, so it hadn't made any error of law there. Therefore, the Supreme Court said, well, no real errors here, but the Court of Appeal wrongly found the tribunal had gone wrong. So in a sense, one simply wraps the point up by saying, particularly in the context of appeals more widely, that one has to look back sometimes at the way in which at least two courts or tribunals have looked at matters successively. Can get quite complicated. I don't think I need to say any more about that. What's ironic about all of this is, of course, the something that one has to remember, that it was Millgate's receipt of 2.5 million on its transfer to Housing Solutions that Millgate took. And it's also interesting that, as Chris has said in his opening, it was the day before the expiry of the trust's permission to appeal time that it entered into the contract to sell the land off and thereby avoid its liabilities also under the Section 106 agreements in terms of actual housing units. So those are the little tidying up points. I don't think we need to say any more about the judgments as a whole.
Just dealing quickly with the resolution of this dispute. So what are the options now for the trust, which, you know, obviously now has this building next to it, which was in breach of the covenant?
Yes, a number of things are coming potentially out of the woodwork here. And I have some sources of intelligence which keep me up to date from time to time, as far as I can be able to receive it and say what I know. But at the moment, I don't know anything directly, but it seems to me as night follows day that, first of all, quite apart from the resolution of the costs in this appeal, there will be no doubt, and it's a point that's made at the end of the judgment of Lord Burroughs, there will no doubt be the possibility of the trust applying in the court for the demolition, effectively a mandatory injunction, that the offending houses on the burden land be pulled down, and or with damages in lieu. And the modern way of looking at such damages on the negotiating damages assessment, quite what the net profit would be from an affordable housing unit would be, I simply don't know. But that, of course, would be linked to the ability of Millgate to make an awful lot of money, many, many millions of pounds in net profit terms, from their commercial, their 75 houses at Woolley Hall. So no doubt it will be an interesting argument on that. And that's the first thing. I think there may well be further litigation. But of course, also one has to remember that the trust itself is a charitable trust doing extremely good works for sadly ill children. And it probably would not want to spend a lot of its resources, even if it could do so, on expensive litigation. So we will have to wait and see what's going to happen. There's no further route of appeal. This is not a case where, as far as I can assess, human rights are engaged. I don't think it's a Strasbourg case. So we'll have to see. But there are clearly going to be knock-on consequences, which no doubt we'll hear about in due course.
I guess there's probably, we don't know what the practical situation is, or certainly I don't know what the practical situation is on the ground as to whether the affordable housing can be satisfactorily shielded from the hospice grounds, so that those units on the affordable housing can't effectively see into the grounds and spoil privacy. If that is something, then one can see that there'd be a much more readily ascertainable outcome. But yes, as Andrew said, otherwise it's over to the usual remedies. And I think the really interesting point is the one that Andrew mentioned, is that on calculation of any damages, to what extent there could be reference on to the 75 house development that Millgate were able to build by satisfaction of the Section 106 agreement in building these affordable housing. That's the point of interest. But whether there will be further litigation or whether it will be settled amicably, inverted commas, remains to be seen.
Well, tree screening is, of course, relevant because that was the offer that was made, of course, and which effectively turned itself into the compensation at the tribunal level. That was the tree screening. And in fact, I, having seen the photographs of the houses behind the hospice, there's a fairly brutal line of 6-foot fencing with the houses quite close behind. And frankly, tree screening along that boundary on the hospice land would be a huge improvement. And I suspect that may well be the way, in practical terms, on the ground, without even thinking of litigation, it would proceed.
Interesting.
So turning to the wider implications of the case, do you see this decision as a bit of a warning for developers that they actually do need to take restrictive covenants seriously?
Yes, I do. I think it is a warning. I think one has, before one comes to the warning notes, as it were, I think one's first got to say that this is a very unusual case. Mm-hmm. The two omitted factors were quite narrow. And as Lord Burroughs said, they made the facts of this case exceptional. That's what Lord Burroughs said. In terms of reported cases and my own experience, and I dare say Chris's as well, it's almost unheard of for an application to be made to the tribunal after the development is, you know, practically completed, was ready for occupation. There are a number of reasons for that. And the main reason, which contrasts with this one, is that you're going to be developing your flats or houses or whatever for commercial sale. And unless you can get rid of the covenant, unless you can square the covenant up with consensual releases, tribunal order, indemnity insurance, and all the other things, the houses are going to be unsaleable and unmortgageable. Even in the George Wimpey case, which I was sadly in 2011, which is one of the conduct cases, that was where the offending houses to the west of the no-build line had only reached foundation footings and probably first floor wall level. They certainly were by no means finished. In the Madrasa case, the Greenmaj did a Madrasa case in 2013, that was a case of change of use where the conduct really wasn't that bad. There was a degree of confusion, and there was certainly no cynical breach by the applicants, and there was no profit motive because it was to be used as a school. And even in the very old case of SJC Construction, which is the case that went back to the Court of Appeal, back up to the Court of Appeal in 1974, when one reads the tribunal decision of Sir Douglas Frank, and it's also referred to in Lord Denning's judgment, the block of flats that was to be built in breach of covenant in Cheen behind the ancient Tudor house, they had only reached first floor level, and then they were subject to an injunction. So there's been no case of which I'm aware, and of which I've seen in the reported authorities, where the actual buildings have been absolutely finished and ready for occupation before the developer makes the application. And if I may say so, it's only because, or it may be largely because, the houses were not to be, the affordable housing units were not to be sold on the open market, that Millgate could, I suspect, afford to take the risk that it took here. So with that in mind, the first thing one can say is, in terms of a learning point, as we often say these days, the public interest ground, as I've already said earlier, is still an exceptional and very limited ground, and the force of the old decision in Collins is still there. And I take the view that nobody brings an application to the tribunal under the public interest ground, and is, as I often say, nobody with the right mind, exception very unusual cases, will also bring a case in the tribunal under ground A, which is the opposite ground, because that applies in very, very few cases. So the first lesson is gateway, don't use public interest unless you're absolutely convinced that it's going to be a compelling one. Use AA in most cases, the general ground of AA. Secondly, discretion must never be overlooked. This is the warning point. Conduct will always be relevant. And I may say also, it's not just building the houses, it's also pre-application conduct, the way in which you're responding to folk, and of course the cost discretion which comes at the end of all of this anyway. Thirdly, no developer will want to be branded with the brand cynical breach. That is an appalling thing, really, to be branded with. And no, certainly no private individuals would want to be described in that way. And it's a pretty unpleasant description, really, justified, I fear, for a developer who's conducted themselves in this particular manner. Fourthly, it's tempting to brush off objections with short and, frankly, sadly, ill-considered letters saying, no, we don't think you've got the benefit. This is, in fact, what happened in George Wimpey, where George Wimpey's brushed off the objections before the involvement of any solicitors or anybody else. And as the tribunal said, the solicitors for Millgate, well-known and experienced firm solicitors, could easily have found out who the beneficiaries were. It's a complex area of law, but of course you can do the homework. You can go and seek specialist advice, even to the extent of going to see me and Krista and other folk, and get some spade work done before you start literally putting spades in the ground or even seeking planning consent. And there could have been no doubt about the benefited land in this case, because it was bang up against the site on at least one, if not two, boundaries. So that's that. And also old law establishes, because the solicitors for Millgate were trying to allege that the covenants didn't touch concern the hospice land. It's complete nonsense, if I may say so, because the old case back in 1962 of Martin and Flight Refueling, Mr. Justice Wilberforce made it very clear that in general terms, you will assume that the covenant was taken for the benefit of land, and it's the burden. The burden lies firmly on the burdened party, the obliged party, to show that it doesn't as a matter of evidence. And there was no evidence to that effect here. It's interesting actually also to note that back in 1972, there was an overage provision taken, a short-term, relatively short-term overage. So it was quite clearly contemplated that there was going to be development on the burden land. But the quid pro quo for that was 75% of the uplift. So that was a degree of protection, which rather calls into question the attitude that Millgate took at the early stage, which is that the land was not benefited in evidential terms and there was nothing in it. My fifth point is the point that we've discussed earlier, which is relating to fen tigers. There's nothing in the Supreme Court judge's decision which casts any doubt at all, and it would have been surprising if it had in this case, on the force and validity of the warnings in fen tigers, that the injunction is the prima facie remedy. As Chris, I know, often says in our little broadcasts and things, think injunction. It's the first thing to think about if you are about to breach somebody's rights. And then just some final, very short points. The fact that you haven't applied for an interim injunction or an injunction at all doesn't matter. That was held not to be relevant, specifically in the Court of Appeals judgment and Lord Justice Sales, and that wasn't commented upon or disagreed upon by anybody in or before the Supreme Court. There were actually good reasons why the Trust couldn't afford to injunct, certainly not an undertaking as to damages, given the loss of profits on the Woolley Hall site. Try and think, in my respectful submission, of going ahead and thinking of, well, how can we deal with this? Think of cutbacks in rights of right cases. Think of modification. In this case, why couldn't you build most of it on the unencumbered land, or at least away from the boundary with the hospice? And then my final little point is, what does the judgment not do? It doesn't make any comments on what I call the usual ground, which is paragraph AA, practical benefits of substantial value or advantage. That was a point, in fact, which had been run in the tribunal, and Millgate lost on that ground, and there was no cross appeal of that part of the decision by Millgate to the Court of Appeal. So that was never dealt with. Nor does the Supreme Court deal with this vexed question of compensation in the tribunal, as opposed to the general position in civil litigation on negotiating damages. Many of us will remember the words of Lord Carnwath on this, the judgment of Lord Carnwath when he was Lord Justice Carnwath in Shepherd and Turner in 2006, and then his reassessment of this in the short judgment he gave as Lord Carnwath in Maurice Garner in 2018. And then finally, for obvious reasons, it says nothing about the social policy issues that might be raised by the fact you're going to have affordable housing units, particularly that class of accommodation, at risk of demolition, and the fact that the Trust could seek a substantial sum by way of negotiating damages if it didn't want to go ahead with pressing on an injunction. Obviously, the Supreme Court says nothing about that, save the general comments at the end of the judgment. But it's pretty obvious that the court will take a dim view of conduct in a case like this, but equally it will have to balance the social consequences of removing what has been described in many cases before as much needing houses. So I think that's probably all I would like to say about the lessons that could be learned from this decision. It's an important decision. And at this stage, I would simply ask if Chris has got any points that he would like to add.
Well, thanks, Andrew. I think lessons to be learned. There is one school of thought, which is to say that the particular grounds which led to the appeal being dismissed were, as Andrew has identified, Lord Burrows identified, as being exceptional. They were very narrow, they were exceptional, and therefore one could argue that perhaps the case is going to be effectively confined to its facts on that basis. But I think the conduct issue is a very big issue. And although every case will turn on its own individual facts, this decision of the Supreme Court provides a clear statement on conduct, which, in my view, will inform the context for consideration by courts moving forward of the particular circumstances. I mean, in many respects, Millgate's conduct was almost a checklist of how not to do things. So it's unlikely that that's going to be repeated, but it will inform the conduct. So I think that's important. I certainly agree with Andrew's analysis on public interest and the use of that or the non-use of that moving forward. I suppose as an overall reflection in terms of points to learn, this is the first time, as was commented right at the outset, that Section 84 has been considered by the highest court in the land. I don't think that this is a case which is going to result in a great deal of rewriting of the textbooks, whether that be Andrew's excellent text or others. There'll be a lot of references to it, but it's not a case which results in a change in the legal landscape, in my view.
Brilliant. Well, thank you both for explaining in great detail the significance of the decision. You have been listening to On the Case from EG.